Okay, let's unpack this. Imagine this scene. Tulsa, Oklahoma, June 1958. It's not just warm. It's brutally, oppressively hot. We're talking scorchers, temperatures well into the 90s.
And that wind, too.
Exactly. But it wasn't just the heat blanketing the place. There was a stiff, gusty wind whipping out of the southwest. This wasn't just a golf tournament. It was, well, a test of survival.
A physical and mental gauntlet. You got it. And it earned a nickname it would carry forever, the Blast Furnace Open.
What's fascinating here is how universally that name was adopted. It perfectly captured the sheer physical and mental toll those conditions took.
Yeah, it really did. You weren't just playing the course, you were battling the very air around you, the elements.
Exactly. And that fight is what we're diving into today. The 1958 U.S. Open at Southern Hills. This deep dive, based on the articles, notes, and historical accounts you've shared, is all about what made this championship so incredibly unique.
Yeah, things like the punishing conditions, the challenging course setup.
The unlikely champion, known for his temper, who found a week of unexpected calm.
Right, Tommy Bolt.
And the undeniable arrival of a future global superstar.
Gary Player. So our mission today is really to distill the key insights from this event and understand its lasting legacy.
Let's start with the stage itself, Southern Hills Country Club.
Okay.
Designed by Perry Maxwell and opened in 1936, 1958 marked its very first time hosting a major championship.
And this wasn't just any major debut. It was the US Open, the 58th edition. Bringing the Open to Tulsa represented a significant geographical expansion for the championship.
Yeah, it had traditionally stuck closer to the coasts or the Northeast and Midwest.
Right. So moving into Oklahoma, a region some even loosely termed the Southeast back then, climate-wise, well, it signaled a new era for where America's national championship could be held.
Very different kind of test for the players.
Definitely. And that test was heightened because, like many U.S. Open venues preparing for the spotlight, Southern Hills received some strategic modifications.
Robert Trent Jones Sr., often called the Open Doctor, came in 1957.
Brought in specifically to ensure the course would be a formidable test for the national championship.
Right. And Jones's touch meant pushing back tees to lengthen holes, narrowing fairways significantly by letting the rough grow.
And adding new bunkers. Crucially, the par was adjusted from the club's standard 71 down to a much more demanding 70.
Playing at 6,907 yards, which was pretty long for 58.
It was. But even after his changes, the sources note Jones paid high tribute to Maxwell's original design, praised its inherent brawn.
And he warned them off making more changes, didn't he?
Yeah, reportedly told the club management they'd be a fool to let anyone make further changes. He recognized the genius was already there. He was just, turning up the volume for the open.
High praise indeed. And history proved him absolutely right. That 1958 Open was just the beginning for Southern Hills.
Just the start. By 2022, it would go on to host a total of 8 men's professional majors, 3 U.S. Opens, and 5 PGA championships.
So it immediately stamped its identity as a truly significant championship venue.
No question. And that identity was forged right there in the crucible of the 1958 conditions, leading directly to that famous nickname.
The Blast Furnace Open. It wasn't just a catchy phrase, was it? The sources paint a picture of extreme environmental stress.
Oh, yeah. Temperatures consistently above 90 degrees Fahrenheit, described as scorching heat.
But maybe even worse was that high, gusty wind from out of the southwest.
Right. It wasn't just an annoying, it made judging distances almost impossible. It just wreaked havoc with ball flight, turned well-struck shots into, well, guesses sometimes.
And if the heat and wind weren't enough,
Yeah.
then there was the rough.
Ah, the rough. The infamous Oklahoma-grown Bermuda grass rough.
Descriptions consistently call it tall and thick and matty, just punishing.
And Sam Snead, not usually one for, exaggeration about course conditions.
He had that instantly classic line.
He did. The strongest man in the world can't hit the thing 10 feet out of some of this grass.
Wow. So missing the fairway wasn't just losing a little distance.
No. It often meant hacking out sideways with a wedge, costing a full stroke or more just to get back into play.
And the stories even include suggestions that maybe new mowers were set incorrectly, made it even more brutal.
Yeah, there was talk of that. Whether true or not, its impact was undeniable. And the bunkers, they offered zero respite.
Soft sand, right.
Described as so soft that almost every ball that landed in them was plugged. You couldn't just splash it out, you were digging for it.
Ugh. Okay, so you finally get to the green, and the test didn't let up.
Not at all. Severely contoured greens, made approaches tricky even from the fairway, and the pin positions.
Oh, boy.
Particularly day one.
Yeah, day one drew a lot of criticism, called extremely tough and sometimes ludicrous, tucked deep front and downwind, or placed just like right above these upslope crests, meaning a good shot could still end up.
Rolling right off, tragically. Turning potential birdies or pars into frustrating bogeys or worse.
It sounds like a setup designed not just to find the best player, but maybe the most resilient survivor.
That's a good way to put it. And the scores absolutely reflect that. The scoring average for the week wasn't just high, it was astronomical. 77.92 on a par 70 course.
So nearly 8 strokes over par on average.
Per round. And across the whole 72 holes, only three golfers managed to break 290.
Only three. Out of a starting field of what, 159?
Exactly. And day one, the numbers are even more stark. A total of just 141 birdies and a single eagle.
Across the entire field.
Across the entire field on Thursday. The par 5 16th was noted as the one comparatively soft touch, probably accounted for a good chunk of those rare scoring chances.
It just underscores how the objective wasn't really to attack, but simply to survive.
Yeah.
Not a week for chasing birdies.
Definitely a battle to save par. And the course didn't care if you were. Even legends were vulnerable.
Like Ben Hogan.
Yeah, Hogan, still chasing a potential fifth U.S. Open title. He was forced to withdraw. Actually, no, wait, he didn't withdraw. He injured his wrist trying to escape that brutal rough, but he still finished. We'll get back to that.
Okay. But the point is, players were constantly complaining about the thickness of the rough.
Constantly. It wasn't just a physical challenge, it was a relentless psychological grind.
So, given that relentless test, who had the game, and maybe more importantly, the temperament to conquer the blast furnace?
Well, the winner was a hometown hero, Tommy Bolt. And here's where the story takes a fascinating turn because Tommy Bolt was famous for his temper.
Absolutely. At 42 years old, an Oklahoma native, Bolt's reputation definitely preceded him.
His volcanic temper earned him nicknames like Terrible Tommy, Thunderbolt, Tempestuous Tommy.
And his legendary club throwing and breaking were so common, they led the tour to create a rule with fines specifically targeting that behavior.
Informally called the Bolt Rule, right?
Yeah. And the sources even include him admitting some of it was for showmanship.
Right. He said people came to see him throw clubs and that he was always more of a breaker than a thrower, most of them putters. He knew how to put on a show.
Which makes his demeanor during the 1958 U.S. Open such a striking paradox.
Totally. By all accounts from that week, his temper just vanished. He claimed it was never an issue, that he felt at peace with his game all 72 holes.
And contemporary accounts were astonished, called him Gentleman Tom.
Yeah, playing with great aplomb and control. There's even an anecdote about him meeting a priest earlier that year who gave him advice on finding tranquility, and Bolt apparently credited that encounter.
Interesting. It almost makes you wonder if the sheer overwhelming external pressure of the heat, wind, and course somehow forced him into an internal state of calm focus just to survive.
Could be. It was a temporary transformation, though, because reports indicate he returned to his more temperamental ways later in 1958. So this week was truly unique for Tommy Bolt.
And that unique week delivered his only major championship victory.
His only major. And he led wire to wire, essentially. Shared the lead after round one, held it outright the rest of the way.
His final score was 283, 3 over par. But it wasn't just the total, it was the consistency under those conditions that was remarkable.
Yeah, his rounds 71, 71, 69, 72. Look at those numbers.
He was the only player in the entire field who did not record a single round of 75 or higher.
Think about that. On a course where the average score was almost 78, staying below 75 for all four rounds, that's unbelievable control and resilience.
He won by 4 strokes over a young challenger, Gary Player.
Which was the first US Open win by more than a single shot since Ben Hogan back in 53.
And Bolt was clearly confident. There's that story about him quipping after birdieing the first hole of the tournament.
Who might finish second? Yeah. He credited his driver for keeping him out of that killer rough, apparently missed only two fairways in the first round.
Wow. And he handled the tough holes well, too.
Exceptionally, he birdied the difficult par 4 12th, sometimes called the All-American hole because it was such a classic test. He birdied it in the first three rounds.
That level of execution on the toughest holes shows he wasn't just surviving. He was playing exceptional golf when it mattered most.
An absolute masterclass in course management and controlled aggression, especially given everything we've described.
And his runner-up was a story all its own. The championship debut in America for a 22-year-old South African named Gary Player.
What an arrival on the global stage. finishing second at the U.S. Open, four strokes behind Bolt at 287, seven over par in those conditions. An extraordinary result for a newcomer.
Absolutely. This was really a foundational moment on his path to winning nine majors and the career Grand Slam.
His first round was a respectable 75, but it was his second round on Friday that really sent shockwaves through the field.
He shot a stunning 68, two under par.
This wasn't just good. It was the first sub-70 score of the entire championship. Included a great burst of five birdies on his second nine.
Damn the reaction.
Sources describe it like he was cheered quite in the spirit of a St. George who had slain a dragon. Showed the course could be scored upon. It wasn't invincible.
And that round jumped him from well back to sole second place, right? Just one behind Bolt heading into that grueling 36-hole Saturday.
Exactly. He followed that 68 with a 73 and a final round 71, showing remarkable resilience after that higher start.
And the payday was significant for him, too.
Huge! He earned $5,000 for second place, a sum he later said made him feel like he and his wife had enough money to play this great tour forever. A financial turning point.
And a competitive one. Plus, he had that memorable experience during the 36 holes on Saturday.
Paired with Ben Hogan. Player cherished it. Recounted that Hogan, known for his quiet intensity, spoke only five words to him the entire time.
Which were?
Morning, fella. Well played, son.
Classic Hogan. So that finish was really a pivotal launch pad for a player.
Oh, absolutely. Didn't just give him a significant paycheck. It massively boosted his confidence, his profile, catapulted him onto the international scene.
And he won his first PGA Tour event later that same year, right? Kentucky Derby Open.
Yep. Clearly building directly on the momentum and belief gained at Southern Hills.
Okay, so beyond Bolt and Player, the Blast Furnace hosted other compelling narratives.
For sure. Julius Boros finished third at 289, another really solid performance in those severe conditions.
Gene Littler was fourth at 290. He had the tournament's lowest round, didn't he?
He did, a 67 in the third round. Showed the course could yield low scores if you were firing on all cylinders, but he ultimately faded a bit in the final round.
George Bercomo and Mike Rosberg tied for fifth at 291.
And back to Ben Hogan. Despite injuring his wrist early on in that punishing rough.
Right, you corrected yourself earlier. He didn't withdraw.
No, he gritted his way to a T10 finish at 294.
Wow, that speaks volumes about his legendary tenacity. Refusal to quit, even when physically hampered.
Incredible resilience.
The tournament also felt like a significant moment of transition in golf history while Player was arriving.
Some legends were making their U.S. Open farewells. Sam Snead missed the cut for the first time in 18 appearances.
Gene Sarazen, another icon, missed the cut in what would be his final U.S. Open start.
And Jimmy DeMarais withdrew in his last Open appearance. End of an era for them.
Contrast that with the quiet arrival of the future. An 18-year-old amateur named Jack Nicklaus.
Playing in his second U.S. Open, he successfully made the cut for the first time, finished T41 at 306.
A very subtle entry point for a career that would, you know, define the sport for decades.
Absolutely. And there was even a nice local connection. Jerry Pittman, a former caddy at Southern Hills, finished T17.
Oh, cool. And Charles Arcot finished as the low amateur.
Right. So all these threads weaving together in the intense heat of Tulsa.
Let's quickly revisit the flow of the tournament just day by day to see how it unfolded.
Okay. Thursday immediately showed the course's teeth. Only three players broke par, I think.
That's right. And the lead was a modest 71 shared by Bolt, Boros, and Dick Metz. Gary Player opened with that 75.
Friday saw Bolt post another solid 71 to take the solo lead at 142. But Player's heroic 68 was the story of the day.
Vaulted him into solo second, just one back.
Yep. And the cut line settled way up at 154, proving just how tough scoring was. Send some big names home early, like Snead and Sarazen.
Then Saturday brought the demanding 36-hole test, morning round, the third round.
Bolt shot his best score, a 69, extending his lead to three shots. Gene Littler fired that tournament low 67 to jump into contention.
Player slipped back a bit with a 73.
Right. Then in the brutal Saturday afternoon heat for the final round, Tommy Bolt just held steady.
Despite a couple of early bogeys, maybe.
Yeah, but he righted the ship, played controlled, consistent golf, closing with a 72 for a total of 283.
Described as a triumphal march on the back nine.
Pretty much. Player finished strong with a 71, secure second place at 287. Littler faded with a 76.
And that scarcity of subpar rounds throughout the week, especially in the final round, just really emphasizes the difficulty.
And the quality of Bolt's consistent play, it really stands out.
So the final board confirmed it. Bolt victorious at 283, Player strong second at 287, Bora's third at 289.
Bolt's winner's check was $8,000, which was significant back then, placed him seventh on the 58 money list just from that one event.
And Player's $5,000 runner-up prize, as we said, a huge boost for his young career.
And you look further down the list, the prize money drops off pretty sharply. Really shows the financial weight and prestige attached to performing well in a major like this back then.
And the fact that only three players finished under 290, barely better than plus 10 for the week.
Yeah.
It just screams that this was fundamentally a battle for survival.
Par felt like a birdie out there, for sure.
So the legacy seems pretty profound for several reasons.
Oh, definitely. For Tommy Bolt, it was his undisputed career highlight, a moment where terrible Tommy was overshadowed by Gentleman Tom proving his immense talent when he could harness that focus.
For Gary Player, it was the moment he announced himself to the American golf scene, the true launch pad for his legendary international career.
Absolutely. For Southern Hills, it immediately cemented its reputation as one of the great Stern Championship tests, set the stage for decades of major championship history.
And for the U.S. Open itself.
It reinforced its identity as the most rigorous examination in golf, a test not just of skill, but of endurance, accuracy, mental toughness, a championship where every shot mattered and where par was always a great score.
And those poignant notes of final opens for Sarrazin and Demuret, the quiet emergence of Nicklaus, Hogan's sheer grit.
They add layers to its historical significance, capturing a moment when eras overlapped under the most challenging conditions imaginable.
This deep dive into the 1958 U.S. Open at Southern Hills really highlights the power of external forces, the blast furnace conditions, the punishing course in shaping performance and revealing character.
For sure. We saw Tommy Bolt somehow tame his famous temper when the pressure was at its absolute peak.
And Gary Player announced his presence with a round that defied the conditions.
So what can we take away from that? Well, the power of mental fortitude under extreme pressure is just undeniable.
Right. It shows how difficult circumstances can sometimes force a profound internal change, even if it's temporary.
And how new eras in a sport, or really any field, begin sometimes quietly, even as older ones gracefully exit the stage.
It absolutely makes you appreciate the mental and emotional side of competition, maybe even more than the physical, when the test is that severe.
It makes you wonder, what would you need to tame your own blast furnace when facing immense pressure?